Welcome to the audio version of Obesity Panacea. In today's podcast, we have the conclusion of Dr. Angelo Tremblay's talk on preventing obesity in 2011 and beyond. A reminder that you can see the slides that go with this section of the presentation, as well as the other three sections of the presentation, mental work and obesity, nutrition and obesity, and sleep and obesity, on our blog at blogs.plos.org. So enjoy the podcast, and here it is, Dr. Angelo Tremblay discussing preventive pharmacology and obesity.
By investing in preventive pharmacology, you noted that I added these points. I am not persuaded that it is part of what we should do, but we have to talk about that. So the first time I became sensibilized to this issue was when I invited Eric Doucet to give a lecture in Quebec City. He presented about the impact of methylphenidate. Since that time, I participated in a case study in which, once again, I was the subject. So I tried methylphenidate. I will not show you the data, but they are fitting with the rest of the story. If you wish to know the outcome, there will be a question period. So here, of course, the question is, or the observation is related to the fact that, on one hand, we are facing a lot of students who have attention difficulties at school. So the main object of the prescription is for this issue. But I talk about my colleague Joanne Blais, who is a physician, and who told me, come on, Angelo, not only children. There is a black market of Ritalin for people consuming these methylphenidate-containing drugs to be able to cope with the increasing demand of their work. So, and on the other end, I describe the impact of mental work on food intake and methylphenidate. One of these side effects described everywhere is an appetite-reducing effect. It is not so catastrophic for us. To some extent, it is taking in charge two preoccupations, increasing attentional capacity and facilitating appetite control. Let's talk about some observations related to this specific issue. The very nice studies performed by Nora Volkov at the NIH, who used the PET scan technology to estimate the carbohydrate consumption of the brain during a mental effort while subjects were consuming or not methylphenidate. And you see that mental work is increasing carbohydrate utilization. There is a significant reducing effect of the carbohydrate, of the increase in carbohydrate oxidation during mental work when Ritalin is consumed. So you might argue that mental work is performed in this context with more efficiency. And what about energy intake? You probably know these interesting observations, which were obtained here in Ottawa, and the impact of methylphenidate was examined on energy intake and fat intake. These changes are not trivial at all, and in fact, they correspond to a decrease that is not so far to the enhancing effect of mental work on energy intake. One very, I was fascinated by this paper, so fascinated that I wrote a letter to the editor. So this is the case of obese individual being well known to be reluctant to any weight loss strategy and who had an attention deficit problem. So they were subjected to a methylphenidate-containing medication. So in this case, they used the slow-release methylphenidate pill, the Concerta, and they were compared to a group of controls not receiving the drug. but receiving, as the experimental group, the advice of a dietitian. So you see the weight change over time. So you see the control groups gaining a bit of weight over time compared to those having received the medication, contributing to counteract the problem related to their attention deficit. So, and in each case, the dietitian was there to provide the well consulting, the good approach to eat well. So, I believe that I am close to the end. This is exactly the case. So, what is the take-home message of this presentation? I believe that I do not wish to tell you that physical sedentariness, high fat feeding, and high sugar consumptions are not a problem regarding the obesity epidemic that we have to deal with, but there seems to be something else, and interestingly, not to say surprisingly, the main causal factors in the sequence of determinisms are not factors having a direct contribution, a direct caloric contribution, be it on energy expenditure on or energy intake, but it is rather environmental factors which have regulatory effects, subtle effects on substeps of the regulatory change, with, of course, the consequence to also change the balance between energy intake and expenditure. The first law of thermodynamics is always true, is always applicable, but the error that is done by many health professionals is to consider unhealthy eating as a synonym of energy, of high energy intake. It is there, of course, there is a connection, and sedentariness as the synonym of low energy expenditure, but clearly there is something else, and I believe that this is what I wanted to share with you today. Merci beaucoup pour votre bonne attention.
Questions for Angelo?
We measured, you talk about the Lunchbox Project?
That's correct.
Yeah, what we had in the Lunchbox Project, they had the basic, they had the bag, and they had the option to eat more easily accessible foods. So, and they, each child had a predetermined bag, and then we knew exactly the nutritional, the caloric content of the bag. We were measuring everything that was consumed in excess, and after that, we were recovering everything to measure again what was remaining and then consume. And
I guess my question is, though, how do you distinguish just not wanting to? I mean, sometimes I'm still hungry, I just don't like what's there.
We do not do that. We use the visual analog scale, and the visual analog scale is something like that, with you have one question, assuming that it pertains to hunger. So the question will be, how much do you feel hungry? Something like that. So at this end, it will be not hungry at all. And at this end, it will be very hungry, or I have never felt hungry so much. So, and the guideline will be put with a pencil a mark on the place that is corresponding to your perception. This is soft measurements. It is subjective measurement, so, and because of that, we have tried a lot to validate our VAS with the comparison of ad libitum energy intake in the lab or changes in body weight in the context of weight reducing programs. And also, when we wish to secure our observations, to have solid conclusions, we try not only to measure appetite sensations, we also try to match this information with measurements of energy intake, measurements of body weight, and when we have a good convergence, we feel more comfortable to conclude.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Rick?
Yeah, I guess my question, thanks for the presentation, and always entertaining and now, I guess my question is in line with the unsuspected determinants. There's a question that's it is a possible contribution of organized sport to the obesity epidemic that we see in children, or I would say, brought it a little further, the over-organization of kids' lives. What do you think?
I am not a specialist, but what I have seen is that organized sport, not to say competitive sport, is increasing the engagements in vigorous activities. My colleague Jennifer O'Loughlin, with whom I work in the Quality Project, this children project in Montreal, documented this phenomenon, and as far as I remember well, was able to reach this conclusion. Of course, when you have organized sports, you feel more engaged. You are less exposed to the spontaneous questioning by which, today I would not go. When you have a basketball game compared to going to jog with your dog, the dog might stay inside. you remember when we were playing street hockey? So then that was so funny. That was the highlight of every day when we were playing. So on those days, the motive, even if we had an intrinsic motivation to exercise, for me, it was certainly more engaging and easier to play street hockey compared to go running together 12 kilometers or something like that. So
by extension, what do you think it does for parents? So that's also a consideration that we should have, I think, because parents are so I'm thinking with the hockey moms, for example, that spend most of their weekends in the arena sitting around drinking coffee because it's not a range of organizing the fashion that people would also be.
Yes, it's true. Of course, you always have the possibility to do something. Very recently, I was talking with a mother doing exactly what you describe, a runner. So during a game, going to run and coming back at the end of the game to see the outcome and having trained at the same time. But of course, again, we talk about exceptions. It is a bit resembling to our running meetings. So we always have some flexibility, but so, yeah.
That was fascinating. Thank you very much. I was wondering about other sort of environmental determinants that may be contributing to obesity and diabetes. I had the opportunity to go to the National Toxicology Program meeting in the States just last month about obesity and diabetes. And there's rapidly mounting evidence regarding links between things like PCBs and dioxins and furans that may, who knows, interfere with the thyroid hormone or something. And in those people who are exposed, then they're more obese. Toxic metals, they're also linked, and they are also linked to things like attention deficit. So, when you're looking at treating attention deficit, should you be taking it one step backwards and looking at determinants, environmental determinants such as toxic metals, for instance?
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the epidemiology, which is exploding, we're seeing quite a few of these environmental contaminants that are linked.
Yeah, I had to make some choice for this presentation. It could have been one of the topics. We have worked a lot on this issue, and we came to this issue because of epidemiologists like Eric Dewali and his colleagues, and we tested the impact of weight loss on PCBs being soluble in fat, and which become hyperconcentrated in the blood and in non-adipose organs to measure the disturbance. The news are bad, so we realize that we are all polluted, that when the contaminants are increasing in the in blood, we were interested by the control of energy expenditure, so the hyperconcentration of DDE, of HCB, of PCB 153, 138, etc., is producing a greater than predicted decrease in plasma T3, a greater than predicted decrease in skeletal muscle oxidative enzymes, a greater than predicted decrease in resting metabolic rate, in sleeping metabolic rate measured in the respiratory chamber. So it is producing detrimental effects on our furnace. And you are right. I am reviewing now a lot of papers documenting that when obese individuals are more contaminated, they benefit to a lesser extent of a weight-reducing program. So they, of course, a weight-reducing program might be useful, beneficial anyway, but their positive adaptability is less pronounced compared to less contaminated people. So, yes, it could have been there, and we have even tested the impact of Olestra, the analog of fat that is used by Procter & Gamble for the fat-free potato chips. It only produces a small decrease in the concentration of some PCBs. They are suspected to accentuate the clearance of the compounds. So yes, a gentle, desirable effect, but not so much. So yes, I totally agree with you. Not covered here, but we have touched this issue. The only sad thing for the experimentalists is that we are not able to have a solid proof of concept. We cannot pollute individuals to demonstrate the deterioration of the thyroid gland in response to infusion of PCBs, for instance. You stop me when...
Keep going. The last one.
Okay.
Nope, sorry, the one previous. That's the one, yeah. So, you know, looking at the changes in leptin, if they ate the same amount of food or if the changes in ghrelin and hunger and such, did you notice, so if your main outcome variable was energy intake, so did you notice that whether or not there were, responders and non-responders as far as for, sleep? So say, for example, if someone, there are going to be people who have responded to deprivation by increasing their food intake, if you dichotomize them into responding and non-responding, to look to see where these changes are. So how do they differ? Where does this change in leptin?
I think it was not done. JP, do you have something to say about that?
Not for this study, because it didn't have food intake in this study. Just vast scales to measure appetite, ghrelin, leptin, but no food intake. But in one of my recent studies that is not published yet, I've tried to look at why some short sleepers don't eat more and don't gain weight, and some short sleepers, they gain weight. And in fact, when I split short sleepers with those having a high disinhibition eating behavior compared to those two short sleepers having a low disinhibition eating behavior, those having a high disinhibition, they eat more and they gain weight, and short sleepers having a low disinhibition, they don't eat more and they don't gain weight compared to average sleepers. So it's not one size fits all, and that's all short sleepers will gain weight, but we need to screen those short sleepers, and maybe they have other characteristics that we didn't know.
For the leptin measurement, that was, of course, at the same time of day, right, for each measure?
Yeah, I think this one, that was over 24 hours.
So you did several measures?
Yeah, area under the curve and everything.
Yeah, that's cool. And if you translated your book, I'd help you retire earlier.
Denis?
What are the metabolic effect of these environmental factors on the metabolic effect? Let's say with the increase in weight secondary to short sleeping time, that will have the same metabolic deterioration than being, weight gain through inactivity or increase in
It might be a long discussion. I would draw the attention on one factor, on one point that I did not describe, the proneness to hypoglycemia. So in the medical literature, hypoglycemia is something severe, but in the language of the physiologists, we focus on mild hypoglycemia, not necessarily associated with symptoms that could be an object of medical diagnosis, but which are sufficient to increase energy intake. So we also documented, JP and I and other colleagues in the QFS, that short sleepers and long sleepers as well are more prone to hypoglycemia, being determined as the area under the under the curve when you use the baseline and you measure below the baseline at the end of the OGTT. In response to mental work, demanding mental work, we have also a less precise glycemic controls, giving also some episodes of hypoglycemia. In response to substantial weight loss, we also see an increase in mild hypoglycemia during an OGTT. And very recently, we published in the journal Sleep Medicine the observation in the Quebec Family Study that this parameter, mild hypoglycemia during OGTT, is an independent predictor of the development of diabetes over time. Is it because a resistance to counter-regulatory hormones? I don't know, but this is one metabolic adaptation that is a bit outside well-established pathways that seems to be a common feature in this conceptual environment, and we believe that there is some convergence in all the story. To some extent, to explain that short sleeping and demanding mental work, possibly via an hypoglycemic impact, might make more difficult, might interfere with the success of a weight-reducing program.
I'll just add the fact that fat gain can even be a solution or a good thing for a short sleeper, because when you gain fat, your leptin levels increase, so you just see the opposite here. So when something bad is chronic, like short sleep, gaining weight, of course, it's bad up to a certain limit, but it can help the short sleeper to cope with this bad thing at some point. I think for leptin.
Short sleepers are at higher risk of cardiovascular disease or diabetes than obese patients, high per calorie intake patients.
They are more at risk. Are they more compared to obese individuals? Do you have an answer to that?
I think so, at least in some studies.
But because they are, the other easy part of the answer is that many obese individuals are short or bad sleepers. So because of respiratory problems also, so it is occasionally difficult to dissociate what we explain from the problem of sleep apnea. So
there's one question over there. Maybe I have one, Angelo, for you.
The killing question?
No. You talked about short sleep, mental stress, MPH. So it seemed that the impact of those things is more energy intake than energy expenditure. And some people are trying to explain this increased prevalence of obesity by either increase in food intake or a decrease in energy expenditure. So it seems to be more food intake here. But you think that by increasing physical activity, we can have a positive impact on, of course, we know the benefits of being active on sleep quality, to prevent the orexigenic effect of mental stress, on MPH2. So by the way, having a positive impact on food intake by being more active, instead of just telling people to sleep better and to stop doing some mental work.
We showed that, and some many years ago when Pascal Imbeau was in our lab, he published a well-cited paper indicating that when exercise was performed, there was a facilitation, and the facilitation was even more pronounced when exercise was vigorous. So I like saying that we should maybe more consider exercise as a beneficial stimulus, a potentially beneficial stimulus, than a calorie-burning agent. So it provides a fruitful stimulation of the body that contributes to its functionality. So, and maybe it should be a better basis to promote physical activity than focusing on energy expenditure. With respect to energy intake, even Jean-Pierre Flatt, when he was investigating rats under very well standardized laboratory conditions, was reaching the conclusion that the energy balance was much more determined by fluctuations in energy intake compared to energy expenditure.
Thank you. That concludes our four-part series on preventing obesity in 2011 and beyond. A big thanks to Dr. Angelo Tremblay from the University of Laval for allowing me to record his presentation, and also for providing me with the slides, which we've put up along with the audio on our blog at blogs.plos.org/obesitypanacea. Thanks also to Dr. Jean-Philippe Chaput for helping to facilitate the recording of the lecture. So thanks everyone who's listening. Reminder that you can check out this post and everything else at our blog, as well as leaving comments and subscribing to the blog itself. And don't forget that you can also subscribe to the blog and the podcast in iTunes. And if you do subscribe in iTunes, we would really appreciate it if you would give us a rating. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back soon.